9 a.m. talk is not a good talk at a conference, right? You guys are all sleepy, so please start chugging that coffee. I know. I've been there. So in my career, I've been a programmer, I've done operational network security, I've been a researcher, and I'm now a policymaker. And it occurred to me that Usenix has actually been a milestone in each of those stages. In 2001, I came to the Usenix Security Symposium as a practitioner, as a guy who was responsible for securing a network, somebody who read semicolon login and looked for tips as to how I could better do that. And I had a great time. That was in Washington, D.C. as well, and it was actually my first time in Washington, D.C. since I was a kid. Did not realize I'd spend a lot of my life here. I might have checked out the weather and learned a lesson or two if I'd known that. At the time, I was working on technical solutions to security. I was literally responsible for the day-to-day security of a network. One of my proudest accomplishments was writing a host-based intrusion detection system that when we deployed it on our network, we caught some intrusions the very next morning. I actually thought it was a bug. I mean, I figured, I just screwed something up, right? And that led to 3 days of very late nights, very long hours, identifying where somebody was in our system and rooting them out of it. Super exciting times, and I loved what I was doing. But I also realized that what I was doing was important and amazing, but it wasn't going to solve this problem at a large-scale picture. It was a key part of solving it, but it wasn't going to do anything at the national level. And I realized that I was most intrigued about how could we stop this larger scale? How could we make the United States, as a nation, more secure from cyber threats? In D.C., I have to say cybersecurity because that's the only thing anybody understands. I'm just going to apologize. When I was in your chair, I was like, cybersecurity is the dumbest term ever. Information security has been just fine. Information assurance, if you've got that mindset, it's been just fine for many, many years. Why do we have to reinvent this term? But, sorry. That's the world I live in now, unfortunately. So I moved on. I went into academia, and I started life as a researcher. I researched with some very impressive, capable people who are actually in this room. And I realized that was super exciting, that was a great way to contribute to cybersecurity. And in fact, I came to Usenix and presented a paper in 2006. So that was the second time Usenix Security Symposium was a milestone for me. I'll note at that time that I was scheduled for the keynote room, but they thought my paper was a little too niche, so they bumped me out of it and moved me to the smaller room. I promise it was crowded in the smaller room. Lots of people liked it, I swear. And so from there, I went into government. I worked for a while in the Department of Defense, for some time in the National Security Agency, some time in the Department of Homeland Security, and finally now at the White House. And then here we are, my sort of third milestone appearance at Usenix Security Symposium. I will note that at all those previous times, if I came and I saw a speaker wearing a suit and tie, I was like, oh, this bodes ill. This is not going to be a good speech. Sorry. It's a completely mandatory uniform for us in government. Hopefully it doesn't bode ill. Okay, so what is my job right now? I am essentially the deputy to the cybersecurity coordinator. So he's got two deputies, one for national security issues, one for homeland security issues. I'm the guy who focuses on homeland security issues. What does that mean? It means critical infrastructure protection, securing the government, working on cybersecurity legislation, privacy and civil liberties issues, and information sharing. But today I'm going to talk about everything that we do from our office in the White House, everything that we're worried about from that administration's perspective, and then focus on critical infrastructure protection. So I'm going to talk about three main things today. The first are our priorities from the White House and the sort of buckets by which we think about the cybersecurity problem. The second is the cybersecurity executive order that the President announced at the State of the Union in February. And the third is cybersecurity legislation and what we're trying to do with Congress. And then I'm going to leave a lot of time for questions. So please be thinking of questions along the way. Write down, sort of create two notepads, the hard questions and the easy questions. And then at the end of the speech here, take the hard questions, crumple them up, and come up to the microphones with the easy questions. Come on, guys, you got to work with me here. I know it's 9 a.m. Come on. All right. So, what are our priorities? Now, from the perspective of the White House, how are we bucketing the work that we're doing to improve cybersecurity nationwide? So, we have five. To protect critical infrastructure, to secure the government, to engage internationally, to improve incident response, and to shape the future. Now I'm going to go into each of those five in turn. Before I do so, though, I think it's worth recognizing that we understand that the government is not going to solve this problem. We're all going to solve this problem together. This is not something that the government can, if we only have a little bit better policies or hire a few more people, that we can just improve cybersecurity and make sure our nation is secure. Can't happen that way. It won't happen that way. It requires all of you to do your work, to secure whatever it is you're responsible for securing, to raise awareness about this issue, and to make sure people understand it's important, that they dedicate the resources necessary, that you build in security from the very beginning. Until we do all of that, we're not going to make progress. So while I'm mostly going to talk about what we're doing in the government, please realize that that's only a small part of the solution to the problem. Okay, so let me go through each of those priorities in turn. The first is to protect critical infrastructure. We've really gone about that in two primary ways. One is to establish voluntary standards to raise the baseline of cybersecurity across critical infrastructure, to raise awareness of those standards, to engage corporate leaders to understand how important they are for critical infrastructure. And the second is to focus on information sharing. Sharing information both from the government out to the private sector, but also from the private sector to other private sector companies, and from the private sector back to the government. Now, those are the topics of the executive order and the information sharing legislation that I want to talk about later. So I'm going to put those aside for now and move on to the second priority. The second priority is to secure the government. How many of you guys think the government has top-notch security? We don't have anybody breaking in. We've got it covered. Go ahead and raise your hand. See, that was a safe one, because I knew you're tired. You're not going to raise your hand anyway. All right. So obviously not, right? We have problems. The government does get broken into. We do suffer intrusions. There are some areas of the government that are doing extremely well, but there are other areas of the government that really need to catch up. So how do you deal with that at the highest level? How does the White House ensure that security is prioritized and that security is something that's really happening across the entire federal government? That's a tough job, right? We're talking millions of computers, millions of people, and who knows how many different departments and agencies. You can count them like eight different ways. I won't even go into that. So the short answer is you do that the way you solve any management challenge from a very senior level. You establish your priorities, you establish metrics, and you establish targets for those metrics. Here's where I expect you to be in the following amount of time. I'm going to work with you and get this resourced so that you have the funds to make this happen, and then I'm going to hold you accountable for making it happen. There's nothing magical about that. So what's our process for doing that in the government? On the unclassified side, we had something called the cross-agency priority goals. You're going to hear like 80 terrible acronyms from me. I'm just going to warn you. I mean, that's how we roll in the government. So this is the CAP goals, the cross-agency priority goals. We have three goals for the CAP. The first is to implement trusted internet connections. So what is this? Well, this is 101. This is what you were doing 15 years ago if you were in network security. This is consolidating your network connections to run through a finite number of gateways. And you're thinking, you guys haven't done that yet? You don't know where all of your connections to the internet are? That's kind of scary. Yeah, that is kind of scary. I will plead at least that the scale of the challenge in the government is pretty vast. When we started this project, we had, I can't tell you exactly how many we had because we thought we had like 6,000 connections to the internet. Oh, no. We had tens of thousands of connections to the internet. Every time we think we're making progress, we find a whole slew of connections that we never knew existed. But the good news is that we are making progress. Slowly, sometimes we move backwards as we discover new connections, but we are over time consolidating. And so we will have moved from tens of thousands of connections to the internet to about 50 connections to the internet. And as you all know, while perimeter security isn't the only answer, we're not going for the hard shell, the smooshy inside, but also, if you don't have perimeter security, you're in real trouble. If for nothing else, then it's harder to detect the exfiltration as your information flows outward in ways that you never planned for. So that's the first of these priorities for securing our unclassified networks. The second priority is called HSPD-12. Again, because we're into the snazzy acronyms. Essentially, this is two-factor authentication. So in about 2004, the government came up with these cards called PIV cards, personal identity verification cards, that are essentially a smart card. And the goal was to unify physical and logical access. So the goal was I, as a government employee, could show up at any different department. And to get into the building, I would have to not just show this card, which is where we are now, right? Show your driver's license, but actually stick the card in a reader, enter my PIN, and then they would get real-time information as to whether I was still a government employee, see my picture flash up on screen, and essentially be able to do a physical verification, tied to logical verification. So then I walk into this building, I sit down at my computer, I plug my card into a reader, and that's my two-factor authentication, even for my desktop computer. And by tying those together, we can also say, hey, Andy is supposedly logged in at this computer, but he's not in the building. That's probably not good. So this is a really tough challenge. And it's been made more tough, of course, by the evolution of how we use computers. So in 2004, 2005, it was conceivable that a smart card form factor would be the entire solution to our problem of online authentication. How many of you have picked up your iPhone or your BlackBerry and found the little card reader slot on it? Again, like, this is safe. I know you're not going to raise your arms. It's 9 a.m. So none. There are no card readers, obviously. And so you can say, all right, well, what does this two-factor authentication standard mean as we move to a place where we're logging in from home more often, where we have mobile devices whose form factors aren't suited to the idea of a card? And that's something we're struggling with. I won't tell you we have an ideal solution. There are temporary solutions. There are ways where we can accept a little bit more risk, but it's not a perfect solution at all. That being said, what we can absolutely push to completion on is desktops, right? So we still have plenty of desktops in the government. We have all these card readers on them. There's no reason we can't be using these cards to authenticate ourselves and use two-factor authentication on the desktop. DOD, by the way, has done a great job of this and is really already there. So DOD, the Department of Defense. So the rest of the government is now catching up. So that was our second priority for within the government. The third priority for the government is continuous monitoring. Now, it's like 9:15 now, so I'm going to ask a question where I expect you to raise your hand. So everybody pay attention now. How many of you have heard of continuous monitoring? All right, okay, see, finally some hands. A little shy hands, though. They're like, right around there. Oh, there we go. That man is proud to know about continuous monitoring. Okay. All right. Yeah, okay, we got a revival going now. Now this is good. So continuous monitoring, from our perspective, at the highest level, is really about two things. It's about measuring how secure we are, knowing all the time how many vulnerabilities do we have that are unpatched, how many systems do we have whose configuration has deviated from our standard configuration. But it's also about incentivizing, and this gets lost a lot in the conversation. The places that have been most successful with continuous monitoring essentially have dashboards, report cards, that go all the way down to the operational levels of the organization, where a system administrator can come in the morning and say, look, I'm a guy who cares about security. I've got a million things I have to do. I know that I will never be able to put enough time and security as I want to put in, but I can carve out an hour this morning to work on some security problems. We don't want that person to spend the hour trying to figure out what to work on. We want them to very clearly know, hey, biggest problem you've got right now is this one patch that is for a vulnerability we know is being exploited, and you haven't installed it. Help us out, get this installed really quickly. Or your firewall configuration is totally messed up. So we want to provide that information right at their fingertips so that when they come in the morning, they don't have to sit around and think, what is the best thing for me to do on security today? At the same time, as we go up to their bosses, to the people who are responsible for a given system, we want to create a little friendly competition. And so they get scorecards too, and they see how they stand with respect to their peers. Are they in the top percentile? Are they in the bottom percentile? If they reach a certain point below the average, they're going to get first a letter saying, hey, this is a problem. If nothing happens, we're going to act on it. And then eventually phone calls and increasingly unpleasant activity from their management. So we combine this system of both visibility and incentivization through continuous monitoring. This is really tough. So at the easiest stage, you know, you're monitoring your Windows computers. That's a pretty doable thing. We need to get to a point where we're monitoring pretty much anything with an IP address on our networks. And that means a lot of devices that right now are really tough to monitor, where there may not be a standard configuration, or where there may not even be a tool that enables us to do that monitoring. But that's the plan for continuous monitoring. So those are our three goals for securing the government. Continuous monitoring, HSPD-12, essentially two-factor authentication, and trusted internet connections, essentially consolidating our internet connections through secure gateways. All right, so hopefully, I realize this is tough without a slide deck sometimes to follow the structure. I could have slides, but then White House lawyers would like leap out of the walls and assassinate me. We're not really keen on having written down things. Yeah, I realize that would be vastly entertaining for you guys, but it would really not be as fun for me. So here's where we stand. So we're going to talk about the priorities of the government. The first of the administration for cybersecurity. The first was to protect critical infrastructure, which we're going to come back to. The second was to secure the government. So I just told you about our priorities in that space. The third is to engage internationally. So if you deal with cybersecurity on a daily basis, you're thinking, oh man, I can have the greatest defenses in the world, but if people feel no consequence for continuing to try to intrude upon me, then I'm eventually going to lose, right? They're going to get in at some point. So how do we raise the cost? How do we encourage the most advanced actors to not constantly be trying to intrude upon you? As an aside, you'll notice that I really use the word intrude different from the word attack. So that's something that's really important to us. I think if you read most newspaper articles, everything's an attack. If you look at this from the international perspective, it really makes a big difference. You start talking about attack, and people start talking about things like, have you crossed red lines? Do we attack in response? And if we attack in response, we may attack with bombs and bullets. And so these things matter. These distinctions make a difference. Whereas intrusions, although we don't like them, fall under a fairly traditional realm of espionage, with one distinction that I'll come back to. Okay, so we're engaging internationally. We're trying to raise the cost for our adversaries for their efforts to intrude upon or attack us. How do we do that? If you're on the outside, if you're on the front lines trying to secure your systems, it looks like the government isn't doing anything, and it's probably very, very frustrating. It certainly was when I was working in that space. And the reality is the change that the government can accomplish at that scale is going to be really, really slow. So this is not a problem that we can solve in 1 year or 2 years. If we make significant progress in 5 years, I'll be very happy. So I keep teasing you, but I'm not telling you what we're doing, right? One thing we're doing is we're engaging the Chinese government. Again, if you've been reading the papers, you've probably seen this. It started about 6 or 8 months ago. We started raising this issue increasingly vocally. And there's a sort of formal dance for how you do this type of diplomacy. You start by saying things in a few speeches, and you start raising it increasingly vocally. Then you start perhaps talking about it in the media. And then you end up where you form a working group. This is government. We solve problems by talking, people. So we formed a working group with the Chinese government at the Strategic and Economic Dialogue, and we first held that working group in July. We feel very pleased with the outcome of that working group, and we hold a lot of hope for how we can make progress in that space. Again, it's not going to be rapid progress. But one of the key points that we're trying to make is that there is essentially a norm of behavior with respect to espionage that distinguishes economic espionage from traditional espionage. Traditional espionage is all about governments stealing their military and government secrets from other governments. That's been around kind of a while. It's probably going to be around for a while. Economic espionage is different. Economic espionage is when a government steals secrets from a private sector company and hands them to a private sector company in their own nation for that company's economic benefit. It's about stealing for the purposes of advancing your own nation's companies. That is something that is really not acceptable, and that most nations recognize as not acceptable. And that's a distinction we're really trying to hammer home. We're also working with the Russians. So this news wasn't really widely picked up on, but about 6 weeks ago now, I think, maybe 8 weeks, we announced that we had started a series of confidence-building measures with the Russian government with respect to cybersecurity. So those were the results of a very lengthy, set of negotiations, and include some things like essentially a red phone for cybersecurity incidents. Small steps, you know, better connecting our certs. These are small steps, but they are the ways that governments build confidence with each other and reach a point where they can make more significant steps. So that's the priority of engage internationally. The fourth priority is to improve incident response. Now, about a year ago, we had a national level exercise. Did you guys hear about this national level exercise? Okay, a few folks in the front. All right, so some folks did. You know, essentially a national level exercise, these are primarily focused on physical incidents, or historically they have been. They happen every 2 years. This year is an off year. Next year will be an on year. The one prior to this cybersecurity one was a simulated earthquake in the New Madrid Fault, which encompasses a rather large number of states. So this is the kind of thing where essentially you can think of this as FEMA working with state and local governments to practice responding to a major incident, like a major hurricane, a major earthquake, you name it. Well, we did one last year for cybersecurity. It wasn't perfect. I think a lot of the folks in it were like, okay, this is a little bit of an unrealistic scenario. Unquestionably true. The point, though, isn't necessarily validity in the scenario. It's, can we create a scenario that causes us to exercise all of the muscles that we want to exercise? I think we did a great job with that. Now, the good news is we did this exercise. We tested how the government and the private sector and state and local governments would respond to a cybersecurity incident, and it was perfect. We know how to do it. We'd be on it in a snap, no problem. Nah, not so much. Yeah, I heard some chuckles from the people who participated. You do exercises to figure out what's broken, what you don't know how to do, and boy, we figured out what was broken and what we don't know how to do. It sounds like bad news, it's actually good news. That's what exercises are for. You want to discover that in an exercise, not in a real incident. So we spent a year working on improving our incident response capabilities. We've also had this very handy situation where we've had almost a year now of sustained, significant denial of service attacks against the financial services sector. So we've gotten to work on our incident response live for about a year. And as you would expect, we started off pretty badly. I think a good example of this is when it started, we would get thousands of IP addresses from different parts of the private sector, primarily financial institutions, saying, look, these are the IP addresses of the guys who are denial of service attacking us. We would consolidate them, clean them up, give them to the ISPs. That's a very helpful, useful job. Except when it takes us 2 weeks, which is what it did the first time. So these denial of service attacks start and stop every day. You guys know how bots evolve over time, right? IP addresses 2 weeks after the attack. Yeah, Those bots don't exist anymore. That's not helpful at all. In the immortal words of the Monty Python character, we got better. We're now at the space of doing that in minutes or hours. We still need to get better, but we've made significant progress. All right, the final priority I want to talk about is to shape the future. Kind of sounds fuzzy, right? But I think we all recognize that the way things are structured right now in cyberspace is that the attacker has the edge. Now, I'm at heart a defender. Like I said, I started my career defending a network. That's the problem space I love. I think it's harder to do than attacking. I think it's more important. I think it's easy to be one of those red team weenies. But it takes, you know, real courage to be a guy defending the network. But the reality is the odds are against us. We're in Vegas and we're playing against the house. If I'm an attacker and I can keep trying and I'm persistent enough, I will eventually get in. So that's one reason, as I said, that we're engaging with other nations at the international stage. But another thing we need to do is try to help the defender's odds. And so that's shaping the internet, for example. That's DNSSEC, helping to develop and promulgate a protocol like DNSSEC, and now routing security. That's things like building the cybersecurity workforce so that we have people who are trained and skilled who will help us solve these problems. And that's research and development into systems that will be inherently less vulnerable, or programming methods that will lead to more secure systems over time. So those were the White House's priorities, right? Protect critical infrastructure, secure the government, engage internationally, improve incident response, and shape the future. All right, let me go over the executive order on improving critical infrastructure cybersecurity. The president announced this at the State of the Union last year. This is a big deal. To our knowledge, cybersecurity, or computer security, or information security, have only been mentioned twice in State of the Union addresses. One was the prior February, when the president announced that he was asking the Congress for legislation, and once was this February, when the president announced the executive order. The executive order, so this is the time where you notice that I'm all about lists. I promise you, when I type all this stuff out, I indent it, I use squirrely brackets, and it's like semicolons at the end of each line. I mean, it's like the C coder comes out in me. But it's a little harder when I'm just telling it to you. So I'm going to give you another list. So now we're in the executive order on improving critical infrastructure cybersecurity. And in that executive order, we try to accomplish four things. The first is information sharing. So I tell you what, sometimes I get tired of information sharing. The government's been talking about it since 1998. It feels like a motherhood and apple pie answer to the problem, right? Like the government wants to share information. Well, that's easy for the government to do. It's not that controversial. It's kind of a way of punting on the harder problems. Sometimes I feel that way, and sometimes I think that's accurate. But there are other times when I really talk to folks, and they say, yeah, but there are real things that we need from the government, real things that we need to share with each other, and we can make a lot of progress. And that's also true. So I think there's truth on both sides there. What we really need on information sharing, at a minimum, is the ability to tell people when we have incidents. So we have a sense of the scale, for example, of a single intruder's activities. And to share indicators of intrusions. Because we need to be in a space where if an advanced adversary is caught in one place, then we're all protected against that adversary. Right now, we're in the space where it's really hard to catch an advanced adversary, and everybody has to start from scratch. And that's not a good place to be. So we do need to share information. We need to share information so that being caught or successfully defending yourself and attacking an intruder in one place means that we're all protected. So this executive order focuses on information sharing from the government out to the private sector. Why is that? Is that because we think it's the most important type of information sharing? Not at all. In fact, I would argue that the combined knowledge of the private sector vastly exceeds that of the government. So you could say the very most important information sharing is to let you and the private sector talk to each other. Now, if you work at a smaller organization, you think that's easy, right? I just call a guy up or send him an email, whatever, we talk. Larger organizations that have lots of lawyers find that a little bit more challenging. But the executive order focuses on the government sharing information outwards because that's what the government can do under our current authorities. That's what Congress has set us up so that we can do right now. In our legislative efforts, we're pushing for help on the other types of information sharing, and I'll come back to that. So our first solution under the executive order for, and our first attempt at information sharing is we're going to issue more clearances to critical infrastructure owners and operators. Now this is really important. We do have classified information that is useful for people who are responsible for securing their networks or is useful for educating their CEOs as to why they need to invest in cybersecurity. So we absolutely need to do that. The executive order tasked DHS to start that program up, and they have restarted it. I would love to tell you that we're in great shape now, that we've solved that problem, we can move on. I can't say that yet. DHS has started this program, and they are going through the process of investigating people to give them these clearances. But we don't have people who've come out the other end who have clearances yet. And we're not going to declare success until we have a steady pipeline of people with clearances. But even when that program is working successfully, it's not enough. We cannot issue enough clearances to everybody we need in critical infrastructure for them to be able to protect themselves. So we also have to change the culture of the government and classify less. We have to change it so that we either take classified information and declassify it, or recognize that it doesn't need to be classified in the first place, for at least key parts of our information. So why don't we just do that? Why is that so hard? I mean, the truth is that there's risk anytime you talk about sharing information. And from our perspective, some of our information we gather through intelligence. Sometimes that information came from a person whose life could be at risk if it gets too widely dispersed. But even more than that, even for information that's not that precious, where we don't have to worry about revealing the source as much, we have found in certain cases when we share information, it loses its value almost immediately. We've spent months uncovering an adversary, really learning about them, developing sophisticated signatures to help people catch them, release those signatures, and discovered, even not release them widely, you know, release them to just key companies, and discovered that our adversaries changed their behavior within days. And so we're in this trap where sometimes when we share information, it loses its value almost immediately. On the other hand, if we don't share the information, it doesn't have a heck of a lot of value there either. So how are we dealing with this? Well, the first is we're going to accept more risk. And that's really what the executive order accomplishes. It tasks the government with increasing the volume, timeliness, and quality of the threat information we provide to the private sector. Essentially, this is saying to government agencies, look, every time you're going to share information, you're going to do a trade-off, a cost-benefit trade-off. Is it worth sharing this information? Will people derive enough benefit? And we're saying, look, when you don't know the answer to that, share it. When you're uncertain, or you feel like it's even, share it. There will still be times when you choose not to share information, but when you're in doubt, share it. Accept the risk. That's a key part of the solution. But again, there will still be pieces of information that we don't share. So what's our solution to that? Our solution is a program called Enhanced Cybersecurity Services. Now, I feel like we do a terrible job of branding, and so I was like advocating that we name this program Ben-Hur. I think that would be way cooler. Nobody accepted that. If you guys have better names, I want to hear them in the question and answer session. Gladiator something, cool. I feel like in the 50s and 60s, the government did a better job of naming things. All right, so Enhanced Cybersecurity Services. What is this? What is this program? This is an audience that I'm actually quite lucky to have because I can't normally explain it in these terms to the audiences I speak to. Essentially, we're talking about an intrusion protection program. An intrusion protection system that uses classified signatures. So how does that work? Essentially, the government gives classified signatures to private sector service providers. And these service providers have gone through the program of having people with clearances. They have rooms that are essentially accredited to store classified information. They're called SCIFs in Washington, D.C. So these, and that's not cheap, right? So these service providers have gone to that effort, then a critical infrastructure company, let's, you know, generic power plant, can now just pay this service provider, route some of their traffic through the service provider, and receive protection from these signatures. Now, this isn't ideal. If you're a sophisticated company, you're thinking, all right, I can send some of my traffic through what is essentially a black box, have malicious traffic blocked, but it doesn't make me better at security, right? Because I don't get to figure out what was it about this particular piece of traffic that was malicious. What was the clue? So that's frustrating for you. But most companies aren't that sophisticated. So you look at our critical infrastructure, whole lot of small companies out there, municipal water supplies, small electric companies, you name it. They aren't that sophisticated, and what they want is just help us out. Help us protect ourselves. We're never going to have the in-house capability to do the sophisticated work, so we're always going to be outsourcing it. This is a useful tool for us to have as part of our useful tool for us to have in our toolbox. It's not a silver bullet. We aren't promising that this will solve all your problems. It absolutely won't. And where we'd like for you to be is to have a security operations center with really smart people in it, detecting intruders, kicking them out. But we realize that not every company is going to be able to afford that. So this is a tool that helps those, particularly who can't afford it. All right. Second thing the executive order does, privacy and civil liberties. So this executive order is about the government sharing information out to the private sector. Not as many privacy and civil liberties challenges there, but there are still some. There are people who are concerned about what type of information, for example, will the government share. So what we've done is create a privacy and civil liberties oversight regime that we're quite proud of. You can look in the executive order and see how it works out. I think one thing to flag that if you're not in the privacy advocacy community, you may not appreciate, is we specifically reference the Fair Information Practice Principles, the FIPS. So this is a set of principles that have been around since the 1970s that really represent the state of the art is maybe not something you'd use to describe something from the 1970s, but represent the best thinking with respect to privacy protections. For information. It's not a set of clear rules, you have to do this and this and this. It's a framework for dealing with any privacy problem and saying these are the different lenses you have to bring to bear on its problem and how you need to address it. It's not perfect. I think the privacy advocacy community has also been arguing about how to update it since 1972, but nobody has come up with anything better yet. The third thing the executive order does is standards. How many of you have a friend who works at a company that has really poor cybersecurity standards? I certainly do. All right, this is your friend, right? Not your company. Just saying. The reality is, there are companies out there that have amazing cybersecurity that the government can learn from, that all of us in this room can learn from. There are also companies out there that are really struggling. We send people out. We have a set of folks. Oh, excuse me, I'm going to get some water here. We have a team, for example, at DHS, the Industrial Control Systems CERT team, that gets called out voluntarily. People in critical infrastructure just call and say, hey, will you guys come take a look at our systems and see how well we're doing? Now, the good news is, again, sometimes they find companies that are doing amazingly well. But a lot of time, what they discover is they go in and they talk to the CIO and they say, all right, you have these control systems that are running your power plant, super critical. Some folks may call them SCADA systems, ICS, industrial control systems, whatever. These are the things that are running your power plant. You, CIO, are you confident that you have these protected so they can't be readily accessed from the internet? And the CIOs are like, oh yeah, we have them totally segregated from the internet, or maybe we have one connection between our business systems and these control systems, but we've got it super, super secured, whatever. We know this, we have strong segregation. And then they walk down to the control room, and they say, all right, Bob, how do you get onto the control system? And Bob says, oh man, it was a real pain in the rear. So we set up this Wi-Fi network so we could access it from the control room. And that's working pretty well, but then we're at home, it's harder to access, so we set up a dial-in system. Somebody had these modems lying around from 20 years ago. They still work, so we figure that's cool. And then you just discover that there are, in fact, all sorts of connections and internet-facing control systems that should make all of us pretty nervous. So there's just a wide diversity of the level of security that's out there. I don't know why I'm telling you guys this. You guys all know it. You see it. So what can we do about it? The executive order is our attempt to raise the bar for cybersecurity. What we're doing is we're asking those companies and those individuals that really do know a lot about cybersecurity, that do practice it successfully every day, share with us the lessons you've learned. NIST, the National Institute of Standards and Technology, will work with you and write down these standards. We'll take the lessons you've learned, put them into what's called a framework, and we're going to encourage companies to adopt that framework. So what's a framework? It's not a new set of standards. We got a lot of standards. Now, there may be gaps, and we may discover that while we have a lot of standards, we don't have sufficient standards on, I don't know, dial-in access for control systems. But for the most part, you guys use these standards. You know about NIST 853. You know about the ISO standards. If you're in the controls, if you're in the electric sector, you deal with the NERC SIP standards, and on and on and on, right? So we have standards out there. So the framework is trying to do is one, put all those standards in a place that's useful and accessible. Say, look, you want to worry about access control, here's where you go to get information about securing access control. Two, put it out there in a way that says, look, these are the best lessons that people on the leading edge have learned. So this is really, from amongst those standards, these are what people really recommend you tackle. And then three, structure it in such a way that you can articulate it to your leadership. So in some sense, a key outcome of the NIST framework will be a presentation that helps you articulate to your CEOs, if you're the CIO or the CISO, helps you articulate to your CEO what you need to do and where you are in terms of accomplishing that. So, okay, we get this great framework. And the framework, by the way, is due to, the first draft should come out in October. The final version will come out in January. Now, while it's all still an idea, people ask me, well, you know, how are you going to solve this? How are you going to solve that? And I say, oh, the framework is going to take care of it. Like it's a unicorn, right? So any problem in the world, I'm like, oh, the framework will solve that. I'll be honest with you. When it comes out, it's not going to be a unicorn. It's going to be a pony. All of these things take time. If you've been involved in standards development, you know that the first draft never quite catches it. And I expect that we'll be in that place. But I do think we'll have made a significant contribution, and we'll iterate it, and version 2 will be pretty good, version 3 will be really good, and hopefully we'll reach a point where everybody just remembers how great this thing is and implicitly use it, and this is an ideal tool for them. So, okay, we get this framework. It's a very handsome pony. What happens then? And there's really two things. One is regulation. That perk anybody's ears up? Not really, sort of. So how do we do what do we do with regulation here? So what we said is, look, some critical infrastructure is in regulated sectors. Some portions of the electric sector are regulated. Ditto, water supply, you name it. What we've said is, look, if you're a regulator for a sector that's already regulated, we ask you to take a look at your existing regulations and your existing standards and the status of your sector, and take a look at the framework and see whether you need to take any actions to update either your regulations or any other actions to help your sector more secure itself, because there's plenty of actions that are less than regulation. So we very clearly ask regulators to take a look at this. There are some regulators that we can tell do that, and we tell them. But most regulators in the US are independent. We don't get to tell them anything. So we have invited them to follow this process. They may choose to, they may choose not to. But again, much of our critical infrastructure is not regulated. So what are we going to do there? Well, one is we have a voluntary program. So DHS is starting right now to work with the private sector and say, hey, what can we construct as a program? What incentives can we offer you to voluntarily adopt this framework? We're still working through that. We don't know the answers yet. But we're going to try to make this an attractive program, essentially, that people want to sign up for. So that's our work in standards. The final portion of the executive order is the identification of critical infrastructure. Now, you may be thinking, the identification of critical infrastructure. We don't know what our critical infrastructure is yet. Didn't we have all these efforts after September 11th to figure out what was our critical infrastructure? And the answer to that is yes, but with greater and lesser success. So we've done a very good job of identifying a pretty comprehensive list of our critical infrastructure with respect to physical threats. So this thing matters, and it could be taken down physically. We've done a less good job of doing that with respect to cyber threats, certainly in some sectors. And moreover, we haven't always been as rigorous in our definition of critical infrastructure as I think we need to be. And what I mean by that is some of our sets of critical infrastructure are pretty broad. And as you know, if everything is a priority, nothing is a priority. So what we did in the executive order is we asked the Department of Homeland Security and sector agencies like the Department of Energy to go out and take a look at critical infrastructure. And we put a pretty high bar, and we said, what are those pieces of infrastructure where their loss, that are vulnerable to cyber threats, and where their loss would cause a catastrophic impact on the US? They have completed that effort, and are in the process right now of notifying companies who are on that list. So the good news is they did do a properly prioritized approach. So we're talking tens or hundreds of companies, not hundreds or thousands of companies. And that's where we were in the old days, is our list of critical infrastructure would have been the thousands or tens of thousands of companies. Now, I'm not gonna tell you who's on it, obviously. Hello, painting a target. But we are going out and starting the process of notifying those companies. Now, why have we done that? What's the point? Well, a few things. One is just so we understand our national risk. You can't protect something if you don't know what matters and where your vulnerabilities are. The other is to prioritize the assistance the government has to offer. We have all of these programs to help companies better secure themselves. If we know the companies that matter most and the infrastructure that matters most, then we can give those people first access to those programs and resources that the government has to offer. All right, let me move to my final topic. Information sharing. Cybersecurity legislation, of which one part is information sharing. So we're actually looking, here comes another list. We're looking for five things from our legislation. We're asking Congress to help us with information sharing, to incentivize the adoption of the cybersecurity framework that NIST is producing, to update our law enforcement authorities, so that things like the racketeering laws can be used for organized crime online, to update DHS's authorities, particularly for how we secure the government, so that's a sort of internal housekeeping, and then finally, a national data breach notification law. So some of you may be aware of the data breach notification laws that states have, and 47 different states have these laws. I think they're a great idea, they've done a lot of good. From a business perspective, though, that's 47 different laws to comply with. We think we need to, one, extend that protection to the remaining citizens of the remaining three states, and two, harmonize those laws so that there's a single national standard rather than 47 different state standards. That's what we're looking for in legislation. Most people are interested in the information sharing part of that. It is only one of the parts of it, but that seems to be what's drawn the most attention. So let me flag what we're trying to do on information sharing. I mentioned that the executive order is about the government pushing information out to the private sector. We also need the private sector to be able to send information in, so they can say, hey, we had an intrusion. This was, for example, here's the signature of a rootkit that we found on our systems. Or so the companies can talk to each other. Hey, we're getting a denial of service attack from this IP address. Are you suffering that as well? Or it's your IP address. Would you do something about it, please? So some companies do that today. Other companies have general counsels that say, look, I don't know that this is entirely kosher. There's uncertainty in the law, and that makes me nervous, and I'm risk-averse. So what's the monetary benefit to our company of your sharing information? No monetary benefit. Okay, so I'm a general counsel. I see some uncertainty here, which means risk to me. You can't quantify the benefit, and so the answer for me, the general counsel, is easy. No way. Don't share that information. Now, like I said, some companies are successful here, but we need to be able to make it easier for companies to share. And so that's what we're looking for in cybersecurity legislation. Now, when you enter that space, privacy is a concern. Companies sharing information with each other, companies sharing information with the government, privacy is a very significant concern. We've pushed, the debate on that has really focused in three areas. And the government has pushed for strong privacy protections in all three areas. The first is sender minimization. If you're going to share information with the government, you have to, it's on you to make sure that there's no PII, no irrelevant information in that, in what you're sharing. The second is use limitations on that information. You share information with the government should only be able to use that information or other companies for cybersecurity purposes. So this can't be shared and used for, you know, whatever random purpose you thought of. If you share it with another company, they can't use it for marketing. You share it with the government, we can't use it for other purposes other than cybersecurity. And the third is that the information should come into the government through a civilian agency with a strong oversight regime. So that's what we're pushing for with respect to legislation. Information sharing, the incentivization of the adoption of the cybersecurity framework, to update our law enforcement authorities, to update the authorities for how we secure ourselves in the government, and national data breach notification laws. So I want to get to the question and answer session, so you guys can hit me up with all those easy questions you wrote down on that one piece of paper. So let me close by asking for your help. You in this room have enormous knowledge that we need. Please contribute to the development of the cybersecurity framework that NIST is leading. They're having a workshop the second week of September in Dallas, Texas. Even if you can't go to the workshop, read the documents they post online, email them your comments. I promise you those emails do not go into a black hole somewhere. They read each and every one. They often print them out and bring them and wave them at me, so I know this. And you can specify in your email whether you want your comment to be public or not. So if you feel shy about commenting in a way that will be public, then just let them know that in the email. That's a key thing you can do. Another key thing you can do is with respect to information sharing. There are companies and organizations that are successfully sharing information right now. There are lots of different venues for doing this. Our general term for them in the government is information sharing and analysis organizations. Some of the more well-known ones are information sharing and analysis centers, ISACs. But however you do it, share information about what you're seeing on your systems, how you're defeating the bad guys, and help other people learn as well. When you identify a roadblock for sharing information, let us know. So one of the things we're trying to do is really carefully tailor our legislative approach, that we really only solve the problems that people are experiencing, not sort of broad solutions here. So it always helps us to have concrete examples of, this is information we want to share, we cannot share it because our general counsel says the following thing is an impediment. That's really helpful for us. We've made a lot of progress over the last year and over the last decade. I think all of us understand that it's not enough. But I think it's also worth recognizing the progress we've made. This issue is now on the radars of CEOs and senior government leaders in a way that it has never been. And ultimately, that's how we're going to solve it. Not by a top-down solution, but by everybody becoming aware of the problem, everybody doing their part to solve it. So thank you for your efforts in this space. Thank you for doing your part to solve the problem. And thank you for your kind attention this morning. Thanks. I'd now be very happy to take your easy questions.
Hello, Sean Dowland, Treasury Department. I believe this was item 3 on your list, the international engagement.
Which list?
So you mentioned China and Russia, but what about international engagement with allies and neutral countries? Because we seem to be confusing the heck out of them right now.
So yes, we do that too. International engagement is huge, right? So if you've been paying attention, for example, to the World Conference on IT, WICKET, the ITU conference that happened last winter, that was a big push for the US government. There are lots of different venues in which we're engaging with countries. We're helping people build their capacity, even if it's just helping them better develop national level certs. We're engaging with like-minded countries to help develop norms of behavior for what is and is not acceptable in cyberspace. So we're absolutely deeply engaged, not just with people we're worried about, but also with people who we think share our values. We'll alternate here. Go ahead.
Hi, I'm Joe.
There's one over here as well.
I'm alternate.
Yeah.
I'm Joe. I live in Denmark, but I'm an American. In point one, you mentioned the introduction of voluntary standards for companies with regards to security. What are your reflections as a ex-one of us on voluntary standards for companies and their efficacy?
So I think we're in a tough space. I think there is no appetite for mandatory standards. And I think there is a reasonable concern that certainly top-down mandatory standards, being another word for regulation, right? That there is a concern that a top-down approach to regulation will be harmful rather than helpful. We've tried to thread the needle here, right? Where we've tried to say, first, let's come up with the standard so that people understand what we're talking about and we can figure out whether it's a useful standard. Then we ask existing regulators to take a look at it and see whether they're doing enough. Some of them may ultimately regulate because of the standard. We're asking them to really do that analysis. But there are also plenty of places in our critical infrastructure where there is no regulator. The administration's proposal from May 2011 did seek to address that, did seek to create the government authority to regulate critical infrastructure in areas where it's not currently regulated. That didn't fly. And that was not going to pass the Congress, failed 2 votes, and so that's where we are. We're in the space, we're going to work with our existing authorities. And we actually think the executive order has done a really good job of sort of threading the needle, of moving the ball forward while addressing the concerns about unhelpful regulation. Ah, yes.
Rich Johnson, NCAR in Boulder, Colorado. We work with a number of agencies that are subject to FISMA. So your mention of continuous monitoring and the NIST process kind of gave me bad cold shivers. We do operational security fairly effectively, and we find we have to tear down a lot of that to fit in with FISMA requirements, as in doing things in a less secure or less safe manner. We don't do FISMA ourselves because we don't have the manpower for producing a 600-page Bible every 3 to 6 months of person hours. So I'm wondering if you have any insight into rationalizing that whole mess so that we can actually do security monitoring, not continuous monitoring of controls that might or might not actually secure us.
So for people who aren't as involved in sort of security on the government side, FISMA is the Federal Information Security Management Act. And there are some problems both with the act and with how the government has then further interpreted the act. There are organizations in the government who work within the existing FISMA framework and do amazing security. There are also organizations in the government who have essentially devolved into a very compliance-focused approach, who view security as the production of reports about, you know, have they implemented access control? Do they have physical security? This very much, almost sort of safety checklist type approach, rather than, you know, do you have people who are looking at anomalies on your network and responding to them, et cetera. So there are absolutely problems. And some of those problems are with the law. Some of those problems are with the procedures that the executive branch has built upon the law. And then some of those problems are interpretation. And we're working hard to solve all three of those. I mentioned one of our five legislative priorities was to update the government's authorities with respect to securing itself. I was specifically referring to that Federal Information Security Management Act, FISMA, where we're absolutely trying to update it to help us move away from these problems. The other thing we are doing internally is taking a look at our procedures and trying to update them. And then we have key agencies running pilots about how we think the world should be so that we can use those pilots to demonstrate whether or not our new ideas work or don't work, and then more broadly have them adopted across the government. So absolutely recognize those problems. Also recognize that there are government agencies doing really well under this current construct, but we do think that we need to change the construct and make it easier for the government to secure itself.
Good morning. Marcel Simon from Johnson & Johnson. With respect to the idea of sharing classified signatures with certain providers who could then offer protection to, you know, small municipal agencies and whatnot, are there concerns about this being seen as an anti-competitive move and creating antitrust issues and stuff?
I am not aware of any such concerns. Mm-hmm. That program was initially piloted on the defense industrial base, so it is up and running now on some defense industrial base companies. The reason I don't think there are such concerns is we have not limited the number of service providers. So anybody who's willing to pay to be to have the classified facility, to have the people with clearances, and who can, you know, pass, in fact, the security checks associated with that, can become a service provider. And we want a diversity of service providers. We don't want service providers of just one type, because I think ideally for us, a service provider bundles this with other services and really adds a lot of value to their customers. So that's the service provider side. The customer side, as long as you're critical infrastructure, you can sign up and pay for this program. And we don't dictate the cost at all, right? So ideally, lots of service providers will induce some competition and we'll have low costs.
So Fabio Massacci, the University of Trento in Italy. Hi, I have a question in the notebook. I'm not sure it's the easy one.
Oh, man.
So I was going to your information sharing. So if I look at the classical intrusion, like robbery, theft, police have a very detailed report that is available to the public, not to the other interested parties or the rich neighbors only. So do you plan to make them your report of crime incident in the critical infrastructure available to the public? Because from your own words, it looks like you're not. You just said, well, you're not going to tell you this critical problem for the tens of thousands of companies because you may attack them, which is more like saying, you know, we're not going to tell if there has been a robbery because other robbers will come. But are you sure it makes sense? So you plan to make available data to the public?
So we're in a difficult spot right now where most people, I think it's safe to say that most companies that suffer a significant intrusion do not report it. You can make the case that we'd all be better off if there was public reporting of all intrusions. But I think the world that we live in right now is we have to incentivize reporting. We have to make it worth people's time to report crimes. And one, that means we have to show them that if they report the crime, there will be a positive action as a result of it, that they're likely to have the intruder either caught or in some other sense prosecuted. Two, at the moment, we have to assure them that there won't be a downside for reporting that crime. And part of the downside right now is people are concerned about their reputations. And they think if they report a cyber intrusion, that will have a significant negative impact on their company. Further down the road, would it be good to have public reporting of intrusions? I can see the sense in that. I haven't fully thought it through, so maybe I can also see some counterarguments. But right now, it's just not feasible.
William Allen Simpson, daydreamer. All right. I could probably give a talk as long as yours about incidents that I've seen over the years. But I'm just going to give a couple of examples because I see them as what the government isn't doing. Okay. As an example of critical infrastructure, I happen to own an ISP which happened to serve the Sardis Dam in Mississippi, and I also happen to have helped found a different organization, NSPSEC, that reports incidents, and sure enough, both of their XP machines had been taken over. Well, we ended up having to put a firewall in front of them because that Tennessee Valley Authority said, well, no, you don't have authority to upgrade or do anything with those machines. That's a government authority, and we see this in hospitals as well. We see that equipment, I've had to actually isolate suites within a hospital because it's got to be able to talk to the front table, but the machines are infected and they're sending stuff out that, you know, potentially will infect everything else in the hospital and all the people who come by on their Wi-Fi or are visitors, right? Which is maybe how it got in the first place, because they're not segregated networks in little hospitals. But again, they can't update their medical equipment because there are regulatory processes that keep them from doing so. It needs to be turned on its head. It needs to be, if you don't update them, we will come down on you hard. You're the original equipment manufacturer. You made your money by selling the equipment, but it was faulty. It used Windows as underlying there, which means you have to come out with regular updates or you lose your certification, or we fine you. And I don't see any need for additional laws to do this. This is an enforcement issue. We got to stop thinking of these companies as job creators, because if they are moving the liabilities off onto the public and onto the ISPs, then they're not creating jobs, they're sucking money out of our pockets. So we have a tremendous legacy problem with orphan software, right? Modems that are on major cable modem providers that can be used for denial of service attacks due to not filtering external DNS. Again, this is an enforcement issue. I have not seen any increase in the budgets that come out of the Obama administration on the enforcement, Federal Trade Commission, et cetera. I mean, these budgets have got to be quintupled and tripled. We're not seeing anywhere near enough increase in funding for the researchers. You may not have the internal personnel, and there may be no incentive for the private companies to go and do the research and vulnerabilities. But certainly, we have got. If we want more people to go into this field, we have to have more people who want to go into graduate work. And in order to do that, we have to fund the research, which means we need 100 times more funding. And I don't see the funding as a priority coming out of the Obama administration. It bothers me a great deal as a person who took 5 months off in 2008 and became the Midwest regional coordinator for all of his networks. Other thing that really bugs me about your talk, I mean, other than the classification stuff, is I didn't hear anything about what you're doing to help protect us against the other half of the cybersecurity folks, the Alexanders of the world, who are invading us. And you know, your privacy office, what is your privacy office doing to assist the software providers and the consumers against and protect us against this other branch of government, which turns out to be our own worst enemy? What are you doing to help us?
Okay, so heard a lot of questions in there. Let me try to go through those in order, and I think I can catch them all. So I think first there was an overarching recognition that the government is not perfect, and I cannot agree more with that. So that's one, with respect to our own security, our own processes. And that's absolutely true. And that's one reason why we want to have, for example, this NIST process relying upon the private sector leadership is, I don't know, maybe there's somebody in this room who knows all the answers. It's not me. And so we think that together we have a better chance of coming up with good answers than we do separately. Then you expressed a concern that I think is a real concern and a real frustration for me with respect to things like control systems and medical devices. Both of those are areas where there has been a strong culture of safety for a very long time, safety and reliability. And I think that's great. I mean, obviously, we need that. That culture of safety and reliability often clashes with the culture of security. Because, in these specific instances, the culture of safety and reliability is you do not modify the software on the system. You don't update it, you don't change it, or if you update it, you do it after an extremely lengthy process of testing and revalidation that it's going to do what you think it's going to do. That's a real problem, particularly when these devices then start running essentially commodity operating systems and commodity off-the-shelf hardware or other software. So we don't have the solution to that problem yet. I think if you look in the medical device space, and this is me hypothesizing, I don't know the data on this, I wonder if regular updates to software would actually cause more loss of life than quarantining infected computers. I don't know the answer to that. But that's the kind of question that the FDA has to take into account when they look at this stuff. But clearly where we are is not a good spot. And I'm not confident that the trends are good trends in either of those spaces. So that's absolutely something we need to do a better job on. And that matters both for the government in terms of how we certify things, what our requirements are for updates. It also matters for the private sector in terms of what you choose for the software when you build a device and system. So if you are in any of those areas, I would ask you for your help as well. Next question was about funding. I don't know specifically about funding for all of the areas that you mentioned. I will tell you that we have significantly increased, well, I guess there's two aspects of that. One is we haven't had a budget passed in years. So nothing has, there has been no sort of update or modification for years.
Just referring to the budget that you submit. I understand that there is a recalcitrant, cowardly Congress, but the budget you submit kind of says, where are we leading?
So we have actually, since the beginning of the administration, I don't know this for sure, but my belief is that we have significantly actually increased cybersecurity funding. And I'll go back and check on that, but that's my understanding. We have undoubtedly not increased funding in all the areas that you mentioned, I'm sure. But we have been putting a lot of money into cybersecurity. Now, one of the tricks is actually, it turns out that the government always doesn't have a good way of tracking what we're funding in terms of, at the government-wide level, how do we make sure that we can count what everybody is spending on cybersecurity? We haven't really had a mechanism for doing that. We just introduced such a mechanism last year, in last year's budget submission, rather, which is government budget being complicated is actually the budget for the upcoming fiscal year. We really, for the first time, introduced this taxonomy of all essentially tagging. So every agency needs to tag items in its budget that are related to cybersecurity so that we can then have a sense of how much are we spending, where is it going, and have a better way of controlling, are we putting our resources in the right place. We started that last year. It wasn't perfect, but it was a good first step forward. We're going to refine it this year, in the next few years, until we have a really sensible taxonomy. You have to balance, of course, getting people to do that information with making it so onerous that it becomes excruciating to count, everybody who's ever, patched a single system. So that was the third item. The fourth item, I think, is with respect to the recent, from our perspective, unauthorized disclosures and the real sense of concern, I think, people have about what they're reading in the newspapers. That's not a conversation that, frankly, I can do a good job of having here. It's not the area I focus on. Honestly, if I were able to talk about it, all I would have done was read some very strict talking points, and that would have been boring for you, would have been boring for me, and not that productive. So I will only say that, I understand your concern. I will tell you that we are very conscious that cybersecurity and privacy are very closely coupled, both for the sort of traditional reasons of everybody in the cybersecurity world is like, well, you can't have privacy unless you have cybersecurity. Most people in the privacy world find that a really infuriating statement because they feel like it essentially misses the broader point about their concerns about privacy and from whom is your privacy protected. But there's that traditional approach. There's also the realization that if people don't trust their government, the government won't be able to contribute to cybersecurity. People won't call us in when they detect an intrusion. We won't be able to have programs where we share information and help other people out. So I absolutely understand that both from a personal perspective, as somebody who just values my privacy, but also from a strategic perspective that this is critical for the government.
Hi, Avishai Wolf from Tel Aviv University. I want to bring you back to the question of regulation that you answered one of the questions on before, on the critical infrastructure area. So I understand your statement that you tried to put in regulation in the requested legislation and that didn't fly. So you have political issues that prevent you from doing what you want. So how do you envision incentivizing all of those organizations to actually do something? Because you're really asking the private sector to invest money. You're a CEO of some company and you know that your organization is insecure and you're vulnerable to lots of things, and you can do better by investing money in it. There is no upside to that investment. What's the return on the investment? So if you regulate, okay, you have to regulate. You're saying that your current political structure does not allow you to put regulation into legislation, so how else would you motivate CEOs to do anything? You can maybe insurance rates. If you look at what happened in the credit card industry, the only way that the credit card industry got better was because unilaterally Visa and American Express and MasterCard got together and decided to wield the big stick and say, okay, we're not going to process your transactions if you don't meet PCI. And so everybody took notice. If you look at what's happening in the energy, if you look at NERC SIP, there's quite a bit of pushback from the regulated organizations that they don't want to go to NERC version 5 because it's too expensive for them, and that's regulated. What about the people that aren't regulated? How are they going to be incentivized to do anything?
Okay. So one thing I want to be clear about is what we originally proposed in our May 2011 legislative proposal was not regulations, but the authority to regulate. So essentially the authority to regulate currently unregulated critical infrastructure. I actually think our solution in the executive order is a really good solution, quite possibly better than our original solution. And that is, look, let's come up with what we think the standard is together. And then encourage people to adopt it. Have the existing regulators take a look at it. That will leave gaps, right? There will be unregulated areas where people do not adopt the cybersecurity framework. And we'll have to take another look at the situation then. Now, what are we gonna do in the meantime to incentivize the adoption of the framework? We actually, the cybersecurity coordinator, Michael Daniel, released a blog post on this literally a week ago. So if you wanna Google Michael Daniel cybersecurity incentives, you'll find your way to it. It won't be first sheet, but you can kind of find your way in. So let me mention a few of the things that we're talking about as a result of, the executive order actually tasked three agencies to do a study on incentives and come back to us with their outcomes. And what they come back, and we gave them very little time to do this, because of course, hurry up, give me that report 3 weeks ago. And so they came back to us with their reports, and that's what this blog post is talking about. It links to the reports and says, we got these reports, they looked at the whole universe of incentives and narrowed them down to 9 areas where they think it makes sense to focus our efforts. Now, I can't remember all 9 off the top of my head, but let me hit up a few of them. One of them is, in fact, the insurance industry. How do we work with the insurance industry to make the framework more useful for them and more of a mechanism that they could use in setting, for example, premiums? Another one is rate recovery. So if you're a regulated utility, you have this big new expense for cybersecurity. You may not actually be, you know, but you can't change your prices. So big new expense, no change in prices. I think you can guess how that usually plays out. So one of the things that we're looking at is encouraging those regulators who have a role in setting rates is to accept essentially when regulated utilities come to you with a case for a rate increase because they need to invest more in cybersecurity, to look at that with open mind. Another area we're looking at is prioritizing government grants and our technical assistance. So if you're, for example, if you were a participation in the voluntary program and had adopted the cybersecurity framework, one incentive we could offer is to either prioritize you as a potential recipient of a government grant, or for this the sort of technical assistant and the programs that we offer, you could have sort of priority access to those programs. And it goes on. There's sort of nine areas that are discussed there. Some of those are areas that we can move out right now, and we're moving out on them. Others of those areas are things that say, hey, this is something we could do, but first we actually have to have the framework developed so we could craft a good program around this. And so some areas we're going to have to wait until the framework is already out, and then we can see how we can move forward with them. But it's a tough problem, I certainly agree.
Luis Ramirez, Swarthmore College. You spoke a lot of solving the problem and what the steps to accomplish that would be. But could you be a bit more specific on what metrics you're using and when you would consider the problem solved?
Oh, man. Brutal. How many of you who work in cybersecurity feel like you have good metrics? If you had raised your hand, I was going to totally like tackle you after this conversation and be like, tell me about your metrics. Metrics is tough in cybersecurity. It's tough at the tactical level, you know, where it's just about securing my network. Am I doing a good job at that? It's tough at the broader operational level, and it's super tough at the strategic level. I don't have a great answer for you on that. Right now, the bad news is right now the problem is so obviously terrible that, you know, we know it's a problem. I think as we get to the point where we're really worried about have we solved it 90% or 100%, I will happily deal with metrics on that day. That will be a problem I would love to have.
Yes, sir. Peter Kraljic. In the areas of privacy and security, I was wondering if there's legislation or just thinking and along these lines in terms of defining property. In other words, is the picture of my face my property or my genome or... Obviously, there's clear laws for my house that I own in terms of what's my property, but a shirt I buy, there's almost nothing. But just wondering in the area of sort of digital information, what is mine, what is shared, and what is not mine and can be public? Because I think that's where government really needs to define if some company does something with something that law would define as mine without my approval or without paying me for it. I was just wondering, is there any sort of areas that people are thinking or academics looking at that? Thank you.
Yeah, that's a really interesting question. And I think that's one, it's okay, you say that, or you propose that government could define that. I think I would actually say that we as a society have to define what our thoughts in that space are. And that it could potentially be a role for the government to essentially record that consensus. But I don't think that we as a society have really decided what we want, certainly in the sort of commercial sphere with respect to our data and the things that we get from sharing our data. I would point you to the Commerce Department released what's called a green paper on commercial internet privacy. And then there was a successor White House document about, I think it was December 2012. I would point you to take a look at that to sort of see where we're thinking, but that is a really tough problem. And you know, I expect all of you, or if you're working in a product or a services company, are dealing with that problem as well. So I don't have an answer, I'm afraid. Stuart?
Stuart Schechter, Microsoft Research. I have the most probably remedial question. At the very beginning of your talk, you briefly explained that the office you're in is divided into national cybersecurity and homeland security. And the Venn diagram between national and homeland has always been very hard for me to figure out. And for physical stuff, I kind of understand that homeland means like what was law enforcement and national is kind of what was intelligence. But that division doesn't seem so clear to me when it comes to information security or cyber. Can you clarify that a bit more for us?
Yeah, that's a really good point. And I'll be honest with you, it's a little bit of a division of convenience in our office. It's based more upon the sort of skill set that I have and that the other individual in our office who focuses on national security have more than anything else. But sort of roughly, so first of all, the answer is going to be more of a practical answer than a theoretically pure answer. So the practical way that we divide that is things like anything involving critical infrastructure, involving securing the government, essentially the security of a network based in the U.S., is in my realm. He deals with issues like diplomacy, military, you know, what constitutes an act of war in cyberspace, intelligence, etc. And so that's really on the other gentleman's side. But there's not a great answer for that. I think it is quite blurred in cyberspace.
Hi. The second question I had was on matters of international engagement. I'm wondering how much of that is meant to actually help implications on the public. So many people in this audience spend so much time combating spam, explaining to grandmas about Nigerian scams, military scams, denial of service, etc., which is coming from external agents. And yet, of course, we have to deal with it as both as professionals and as society. So I'm wondering what can be done from your offices, because of course this is outside the remit of the FTC and the like.
So wait, before you sit down, this is the second question you've asked, and both times I've really tried to figure out what the text on your shirt says. Could you raise the badge? I'm super
Sorry.
Curious.
Sorry, it says, go away or I will replace you with a very small shell script.
Nice.
Not directed at you,
I
course,
appreciate that.
Otherwise, I would have asked a very different question.
I've been dying with curiosity. Second chance, I had to ask. Okay. So, you know, how much of our efforts, you know, I think what you're getting at is really, I think what I'm hearing is how much are we focused on, for example, education and helping people really understand what the security threats they face are, how to reach out to other nations at a tactical level and say, hey, you know, you have this open email relay on your network in whatever different nation, how do we effectively bridge what's happening in the US so that we can notify you and ask you to take action. On the education side, we have a program called, well, we have National Cybersecurity Awareness Month. I'm sure it's blocked off on your calendars. It's blocked off on mine. And we have a program called the National Initiative for Cybersecurity Education. Now, a lot of that is focused on things like universities and university education or cybersecurity challenges. Some of it is focused on national level awareness raising. I think we've done a good job of having a sort of broad awareness raising thing. I don't know that we've really cracked the problem of how do we offer really useful advice. You know, how do we offer advice that the average person who doesn't pay attention to this stuff can use to more effectively secure themselves and be aware of threats on the internet? I don't know that we've really cracked the code on that. That's something we're struggling with.
So it looks like we're out of time. Let's go ahead and thank the speaker again.
Thank you.